Okay.
So I'm going to talk about limits of K3 metrics today. January. Oops. April. I didn't edit the January. Okay, this is not the right file. All right, so so I want to talk about the limits of Ricci flat metrics on K3 surfaces. That's the basic idea that I have. And I want to do this in the context of Gromov-Hausdorff limits. So as I'll say in a minute, if the main point of what we're doing is to look for metrics, limits of metrics, which are themselves metrics on the K3 manifold or on some other four-dimensional space, then it's pretty easy, and the problem was solved a long time ago. But if we want to extend this to the boundary being at infinite distance, then we have to work a little bit harder. And there are now constructions which correspond to the four basic types of boundary components that are known. And still to come are theorems. By the way, the constructions are not due to me. The constructions are due to other people, but I'm giving kind of a description of what is contained in those other results. And if what you want is a picture of how everything fits together, then I think this picture is going to be a good one. So the basic tool is these Gromov-Hausdorff limits. Now, in order to use Gromov-Hausdorff limits, I have to actually take pointed spaces. So I take a metric space together with a chosen point in that space, and I take sequences of such metric spaces. And to get limits, you have to pass the subsequences, generally speaking. The basic idea is to take isometric embeddings of two spaces, pointed spaces, and measure the distance in the isometric embedding space between the specified points. And then you minimize over all choices of embeddings. So if you had a diffeomorphism between the two spaces, you would end up finding distance zero. That would be fine. If you had something that was close to a diffeomorphism, and the diffeomorphism mapped one point to, the approximate diffeomorphism mapped point to some other specified point, then you would get a very small distance between these things. What's not obvious, but is true, and is one of Gromov's deep insights, is that the set of all pointed metric spaces is quite well behaved under taking such limits. So that's the basic framework that we'll be using to try to understand how the limits behave. So to each volume one Ricci flat metric on the K3 manifold, I remind you that there's an underlying differentiable manifold X. It's a compact four manifold, and it has lots of interesting topological properties, which I can review if people want to see it. But to each volume one Ricci flat metric, I can associate a self-dual three-plane. Self-dual just means that the Hodge star of the three-plane is equal to itself. And which three planes are self-dual will vary depending on what metric we've put on the space. So as we vary the Ricci flat metric, we vary the choice of self-dual three-plane inside the 22-dimensional space, which has three positive eigenvalues and 19 negative eigenvalues. So when I choose a self-dual three-plane, I get a point in a locally symmetric space, namely the space of this O319 mod O3 cross O19 allows for both a three-dimensional self-dual space and the orthogonal complement, which is a 19-dimensional anti-self-dual space. I only care about the 3-plane itself or the 19-plane itself, which is why I mod out by the O3 cross O19. And then I mod out on the left by all the diffeomorphisms of X, which are, diff X mod diff X 0, which is the connected component of the identity in diff X. So the point that I get in this space M1, this locally symmetric space, determines the volume one metric up to diffeomorphism. So that's a pretty hard theorem, actually. It's due in this formulation to Mike Anderson, but it really relies on Yao's existence of Ricci flat metrics on K3 manifolds. And it's also known exactly what the image is of the volume one metrics. The image is an open subset of that space M1, which is the complement of a set of codimension 3. And if you want to describe the set of codimension 3 more precisely, you could describe it in terms of elements of H2XZ, which are self-intersection minus 2. And you want that minus 2 class to be orthogonal to each of the three basis vectors, if you choose a basis, for the anti-self-dual 3-plane. So that will cause the corresponding rational curve, P1, on the S2, I should say, on the K3 manifold, to shrink to zero size, no matter which choice we attempt to make of metric. So we actually get missing points from a locally symmetric space. On the other hand, those missing points correspond to singular K3 spaces with orbifold type singularities. So you can have one of those curves in codimension 3, you can have two curves in codimension 6. Similarly, all the way up to 19 curves, 19 curves somehow deployed within the 19-dimensional negative space of the H2X, Z. So the whole story of what orbifold singularities are allowed and which ones get in there, that can be explored. That's not my point today. My point today is to complete the space M1 to allow for those singular K3 spaces. They're not the manifold X anymore, okay? So you had to contract the singularities to an orbifold type singularity, but they're very close to the manifold X, and you can fit them together into a space of pointed metrics of volume one. Okay, so if I didn't have the orbifold singularities to worry about, I would just take my spaces of pointed metrics of volume one. I would mod out by diff mod diff zero, which would be fine, and I would get a vibration whose fibers were X over that space M1. If I'm near one of the orbifold points, I can still do the construction thanks to the fact that the local deformations of the orbifold locus so the manifold changes under those local deformations, but the manifold changes in a very predictable way. So you can actually glue in the smoothings of the orbifold metrics in the space M1 minus this set, I didn't give a name to it, the set of codimension 3. You can glue in the total family to get a total family over all of M1. So M1 has a complete metric on it. X1 should have a complete metric on it. In some sense, X1 ought to be a universal family of metrics, volume one metrics. The precise sense in which that's true, I don't quite know at the moment. Probably you have to go into the theory of stacks, things of that sort, to make sense of this. But I'm not in a category where the theory of stacks exists at the moment, so I'm not quite sure what to say about that, other than by this local gluing construction, I can put together that space. And then just exploiting the fact that I had volume one up until now, I can just rescale all the metrics in question, rescale all of the fibers in the same way, and extend to a larger moduli space, X over M, which again should be complete, metrically complete, because of the completeness of the metric on M. So I go to zero or infinity in the volume direction, and I'll see a complete metric there. And if you wanted to stop here, you would be justified. You would have a complete story of a complete space, but not a compact space, with all of the possible K3 metrics in it. So we want to go further, and we want to use the Gromov-Hausdorff limit idea not just to fill in these loci of codimension 3 with slightly singular spaces, but to fill in the boundaries with lower dimensional spaces of appropriate types whenever we can do that. So the first step I'm going to take in compactifying the moduli space is to use a construction known as the Borel-Serre compactification of the locally symmetric space M1. It doesn't quite give the right answer. We'll see some evidence of why you have to do further blow-ups in some places and maybe blow-downs in other places for this moduli space M1, but it's the right starting point. It points in the right direction. And it's going to be the basis of my analysis. So it gives a compactification of M1, naturally. It extends to a compactification of M in a natural way by putting the volume into account. That compactification of M is not the right one. It's clearly not the right one, but given any sequence, because it's a compact space, I can talk about the limit within that compact space. So at the very least, I have a way to assign limits. It's just that some of the points on the boundary in some natural sense should be identified with each other, and maybe other ones need to be blown up a little bit more than they've been blown up in the Borel-Serre. But anyway, it's a starting point for understanding the structure. Because we don't yet have theorems which tell us that every sequence of K3 metrics has a certain behavior, we only have sort of big examples. The big examples are going to map out the codimension one boundary components, and so that's good. And it suggests what the statements of the theorems are supposed to be, even though those theorems are not yet proved. So I want to start by describing the Borel-Serre compactification. And in fact, we'll have to describe the compactification both of M1 and of the larger space M. I should point out that from the point of view of physics, it's the large volume M's, the large volume X's, excuse me, metrics on X, which are most relevant. But from the point of view of the kind of dualities that I'm trying to explore, the physical descriptions of some of the other points, those are all at small volume. So I want to know basically what happens both at large volume and at small volume in this space. Because I'm doing Ricci flat metrics, and because of this theorem that ties the existence of the Ricci flat metrics so closely to a positive, an anti-self dual three plane inside of H2, because of those two facts, I don't have any further corrections. I'm not just doing an approximate description of a moduli space. I'm doing a complete description of a moduli space. And so even though, for example, there's physical reasoning that is involved with large volume, that will still hold. It'll still give an accurate description of the moduli space, even at small volume. So that's sort of one of the principles that's involved in this story. So let's see. So concretely, if I want to describe the Borel-Serre compactification, I have to describe primitive, totally isotropic sublattices of the Z319 lattice. So the Z319 is a sort of abstract way of describing H2 of X with integer coefficients. That's an even lattice, an even unimodular lattice, and if I have an isotropic totally isentropic sublattice, I can split the orthogonal complement as lambda itself. So isentropic means everything in lambda is perpendicular to everything else in lambda. So lambda perp contains lambda, and when you've taken off the factor lambda, you get an even unimodular lattice of rank, I should have put parentheses around there, k, 16 plus k, and 3 minus k is the rank of lambda. So it's that letter k which I'm going to use to classify, and I'm going to use the facts that, so I get an even unimodular lattice of that rank. If I have an even unimodular lattice of rank 0, 16, it either has to be EA plus E8 or spin 32 minus E2. Those are the two possibilities when k equals 0. But if k is bigger than 0, k equals 1 or 2, I actually have one possibility for each other value. So the way these fit together into the Borel circumpactification is like this. Okay, so I should have made something dotted there. Probably this red thing down below should have been dotted. And hopefully, if I dot the red thing down below, it makes it clear that the red line is below the plane of the projector, and the green are above the plane of the projector. Can everybody see that? What I've got is a wedge in space, which is my locally symmetric space, and I have four different components, boundary components, each of codimension 1, labeled 0 sub e, 0 sub o, that was the two k equals 0 cases, k equal 1 and k equal 2. Okay, so they're meeting three at a time, well, two at a time along red curves, and then three at a time along purple points, and those are accurate in terms of codimension. So the codimension of the full thing is 1 for each of those boundary components. And then if I were to take an intersection of two boundary components, I would get codimension 2. I'm not allowed to intersect OE with OO, 0E with 0O. But aside from that, all intersections are allowed. And then codimension 3, the intersections are allowed as shown. So that describes the full set of boundary components of my space M1, my volume 1 metrics on the K3. And I'll give geometric descriptions of what's happening to the K3 along each of these four loci. Okay, so in Gromov-Hausdorff theory, given a sequence of metrics, which I'll specify by means of Kähler forms, if it diverges with respect to the metric on M, so now I've gone to M where I'm including the volume, but I still have, so I have a complete metric on the space M, right? And I can ask whether it diverges with respect to that metric. Whenever it converges, there is a limit which is either an ordinary four-manifold or else one of these orbifold guys. That's in the interior of M. But if it diverges, then there's a subsequence which converges in the Gromov-Hausdorff distance. But it might converge, in fact, it definitely does converge, to something which is of a different dimension, lower dimension, than the four-manifold that I started out with. So I want to put those lower-dimensional things on the boundary. I can't put them on the boundary directly of script M because I only get convergence for pointed Gromov-Hausdorff metrics. So I have to go up to script X, and then when I'm on script X, I can hope to put things on the boundary in an appropriate way. However, in general, it's known that if you're far enough out in the subsequence, there's going to be some kind of vibration structure away from finitely many points. The vibration is described by pi going from X to B, and the fibers are nil manifolds with specified volume growth. So they're extensions of tori by tori. And in the context that I have here, B has to be dimension at least 1, and the only place where there's a nil manifold coming up is an extension of a 1 torus by 2 torus. Everything else is actually just manifolds. So I won't have to say too much about the nil-manifold case, but that's the case, the most recent theorem is about the nil-manifold case, and that's what sort of enabled me to put together all four cases appropriately. So there are four cases corresponding to the four cases of Borel's third boundaries, and I'll get to those cases in just a minute, and that'll be after I run out of slides, unfortunately. But before I get to the cases, let me just describe how I'm going to take into account the volume. So I have a sequence, omega sub j, of Kähler metrics. I have the volume of omega sub j doing, I don't know what, it's doing something. What I know is that there's a convergence sequence, a subsequence, omega sub j sub k, which is convergent in the Gromov-Hausdorff sense, in a pointed sense. So I have to choose points as well. Now, what's known is that there are three ways that I can normalize my choices. I can either take, so I'm assuming that I don't go into the interior. I'm assuming that I'm going to the exterior. So I can normalize my subsequence so that the volumes go to some finite volume V. I could have taken an initial subsequence of that property that goes to a finite volume V. I could have divided, if I chose, by the volume. That's some kind of rescaling of the corresponding metrics. I would like to be able to analyze every possibility, and here I'm kind of starting with a normalized subsequence this way and analyzing the possibilities from its point of view, but I could do similar things from the other points of view to take the volumes of either the total space or various fibers. So what I'll do is use that Cheeger-Kolding type result. It might not be Cheeger-Kolding, by the way. I needed to look that up, but I didn't have time. Might be some other people associated with that. But I think it's Cheeger-Kolding. So there's a vibration structure, x to b, with the dimension of b. The dimension of the base is d, and then I've got a fiber which has a volume, and I'm only computing the volume on the subsequence with a subscript k. Okay, I used k for something else earlier, sorry about that. Anyway, doesn't matter. Let's see. In the earlier discussion, it doesn't matter. So I want the dimension of the base to be d, and I want the volume of the fiber. So I'm taking my particular point. I'm assuming that it's not one of the points, one of the special points in the fibration. I'm taking its image and then the inverse image of that image. So that gives me a nil-manifold, an extension of tori by tori of some kind, and I just take the volume of that guy. Now, the volume of that guy has to go to zero. That's the basic Cheeger-Kolding type behavior. And when the volume of that guy goes to zero, if the volume of the whole thing is going to a finite value V, capital V, then the image of B has to have volume approximately V divided by V sub K, right? V sub K is the approximate volume of the fibers, and the volume of B has to be V over V sub K. So in that normalization, the normalization in which I'm keeping the volume of the entire collabial at a finite value, the base has to go to infinity and the fiber has to go to zero. Alternatively, I could send the overall volume to zero, but keep the structure of the fibration over B in the limit. And if I, in particular, if I rescale the Kähler form by multiplying by the volume of the fiber, then B will approach something of volume V in the limit, whereas the fiber will go to zero size. So I guess I should draw my M1 and my N.
And just a question, All of those omega jk, they're still Ricci flat, right?
They're still Ricci flat, so everything inside is Ricci flat.
Because trigger coating is very weak condition, right? It's just bound from below.
On the Ricci curvature, perhaps.
And right.
I have Ricci curvature identically zero, so.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm using stronger than just trigger coating. I think I'm probably using Shiger, Colding, Tian, or something. I meant to look it up, but I didn't look everything up. Right, so I have my M, and my M is sort of M1 cross R, right? And so on the one hand, I've got a boundary of M, which I drew in this way. I had these various boundary components, and M was kind of in, M1 was kind of in there, in the interior of this space. But I've also got cross R, so really, when I'm at the small volume limit, which is the case of point 3 there, in the small volume limit, R equals 0, I'm really at codimension 2 boundary points. And if I go to the large volume limit, I have some other instance of this picture where I'm in, where I'm inside of some wedge, and that's maybe the R equals infinity limit, and that's again codimension 2. And then I've got some intermediate value where R is V, right? And those boundaries are codimension 1. So if all I really cared about were codimension 1 boundaries, I would only analyze this original case where the volume stays at finite, the base gets infinite, the fiber gets zero size, and there's not much to say other than what's happening in special fibers. So everything where the fiber is generic will collapse in some way, and there are certain special fibers. We can say what happens at special fibers, but in a way, that's the least interesting of the cases. If I have volume zero, which is somehow the most interesting case to me, for volume zero, I'm going to have a finite size B. And actually, with a finite size B, I can dispense with the with needing the point in the Gromov-Hausdorff limit. So this is a case in which Gromov-Hausdorff limits exist independent of choice of point. And that's because the entire space is mapped to something of finite volume. So the points just go to some place in there, but I can keep track of where the point is going, no problem. So the structure of what B is, and it's a finite volume in that case, and the structure of what the singular fibers are, the places which are the images of the finite set of points which are poorly behaved, that's sort of the interesting data for the R equals zero case. And the R equals infinity case, which is number three, the volume of the fiber is approaching V. The volume of the entire space is approaching infinity. And I should mention that I'm going to come to a couple of cases later on where there are two natural scales. There's a Neumann manifold, and so I've got a different size of growth, different rate of growth, for one of the tori of the Neumann manifold as opposed to the other one. And in those cases, I actually have a choice of how I scale. So what I consider to be part of the base, what I consider to be part of the fiber. I don't have a choice when I get down here. There's only one choice here. But there is a choice up at the top of which part of the fiber I keep out as finite volume. Of course, I can then take the volume, which is part of the moduli there, I can take that volume to zero. And so I can get in there a sort of one-point compactification. You would expect a one-point compactification towards infinity in the interior of the moduli space because all of the metrics on K3 are the same if you scale them up far enough up. They just look like flat space in dimension 4. So there is a little bit of issue of what happens with the singular points. So the singular, the orbifold points that I use to complete this space will be a little bit different. But aside from that, I'm going to see a lot of collapsing happening at infinity. So anyway, I'm mainly going to be working with one-dimensional families, but I'll think about those one-dimensional families in these different scaling limits, and that I'm supposed to put into this basic picture of what everything looks like. Okay, so now we're running out of slides. So the first case to consider is the very classical case. It's case K equal 2. And it's the case in which the fibration structure has general fiber, a two torus. Now, if I go to the regime where the dimension of B approaches V less than infinity, so that's case 3 in my 1, 2, 3 series of cases. Sorry, that was case 2 maybe. Okay, I've forgotten. That's case R equals 0. That's the important point. Then what I see is what Gross and Wilson called the semi-flat metric.
Is that the volume V?
That's right. So I could have taken V to be 1, but actually V is a parameter in the corresponding theory.
Yeah, you wrote dimension of V?
The dimension, the dimension stays constant. That's the volume of V. Yeah, thank you. So I get semi-flat metrics. I get a collection of up to 24 points on the 2-sphere. So B is S2. There are less than or equal to 24 special points. And you get a metric which is described in terms of, you get this so-called semi-flat metric, and the metric basically takes the form tau 2, norm tau 2 over... Okay, I forget what the form is. Metric has a special form. So this is the general picture that we have for limits in this case. The when the volume of the K3 manifold is going to zero, the sizes of the two tori, are also going to zero. And this is a case in which there is a physical dual. So I'm going to mention the physical duals in each case. And the physical dual in this case is the so-called F-theory dual. So you have the type 2B string compactified on S2. This was M-theory, should have said, compactified on X. M-theory compactified on X had an seven-dimensional total space, right? So X was a 4-manifold, M-theory is an 11-dimensional theory. If you compactify an X, you get a 7-dimensional theory. However, the act of taking the T2s to zero size opens up an extra dimension. So there's this remarkable fact that a small T2, M on the small T2, is physically isomorphic to this type 2B string on a large S1. So that taking the limit of small t2 is the same as taking the limit of large S1 and produces the type 2B theory on the corresponding S2. Now, if I'm near the limit, not quite at the limit, then I also have everything crossed S1, so you have to sort of study what further compactification you would get on S1, but that's the basic story for the k equal 2 case. So this is the only case that was really known prior to work of a few years ago, which started analyzing more systematically what kinds of limits you would get for K3 metrics. So I'm not going to say too much more about this. Any questions about this?
It's not a kind of, maybe it's a stupid question.
It's okay.
So, but this is really, everything is rigid. For example, instead of B, you could not get any other inner surface. It's exactly...
It has to be exactly S.
And
so right.
Where does this rigidity kind of come from?
If I'm on the K3 manifold, and so in the case of a collapsing two torus, it turns out that you can identify the class of the T2 fiber in H2. In fact, let me do that for you because that's sort of important for making my dictionary work correctly. So what I want to do in the volume one case, what I want to do is take the T2 fiber, which has a volume that's going VK, right, K goes to infinity, and VK goes to zero as K goes to infinity. And then I've got the base, which has volume that goes like V over VK, which goes to infinity VK goes to, as K goes to infinity. So if I have this general picture, there's something happening at the singular points of the vibration, but let me not bother with that for a moment. If I have this general picture, then I see in H2, I see something which has one leg in T2, so that would be, two legs in T2, so that would be volume VK. I would have something that has a leg in V2, so that's roughly square root of VK. Okay, so I can't guarantee that the two sizes are the same, but in some kind of limiting sense, I would expect them to be the same. Times the corresponding one cycle in B, and so I would expect the square root of V over VK for B. I would expect so B was two-dimensional, and I expect actually four things of this sort. So I've got two choices in the fiber and two choices in the base. If I want independent classes. And then I get essentially a VK, maybe V over VK, for the case of just the base itself. So what I'm seeing is a six-dimensional piece of H2. I'm seeing the 3.3-dimensional piece of H2. I'm not seeing the other 16 because those are somehow contained in the singular fibers. But I'm seeing the 3.3, and in my 3.3, I'm seeing one small, four normal size. So in the limit, I would expect them to go to one, and one infinite, one big. So I'm getting my degeneration of the one class. I'm getting my two classes that, this is signature 2.2. I get two classes that stay, that's k equal 2, and I get one class that either grows or shrinks depending on the size. So the point of that exercise, and I'm going to go through that same exercise for the other cases, is to kind of map which cycles are large and small on H2 of the K3 compared with what's growing and what's shrinking on the fiber structure.
So it's something non-trivial like that. It's not because of some trivial reason that K3 is simply connected, therefore B has to be simply connected, therefore it has to be a stool. Not like
well, that's true, but that's not going to help me when I get to a circle, collapsing one circle and getting a three-manifold.
Because you're really interested in the limits.
That's right. That's right.
So, and just, you know, one more stupid question. So is the dream goal is to understand all the picture in that prism, not prism, wedge, to understand all possible, you know, degeneration and all the wedges and all the points? Is that the case?
Yeah, that's right. So, in fact, I know what the special fibers are. There's Kodaira's classification of types of fibers. So there's I sub n, and there's I sub n star, and there's 2, 3, and 4, and 2 star, 3 star, and 4 star. And each one has a specified behavior near it, and each one has a specified metric behavior, and a complete table is known about what the behavior is for these things. And in particular, when you count moduli, you discover that the number of moduli is correct, that most every K3, in a certain limit, every K3 has a fibration structure of this kind. And that corresponds to, well, there's one parameter, which is the area of the fiber, but once you've tuned that one parameter, then you're at the boundary component, and you have all the rest of the parameters. So, So what I was saying in here, because I've got the fixed curves, I've actually got a class which I can choose a compatible complex structure on the K3 surface to make it an algebraic class. And that's what actually gives me the algebraic structure on the K3 lattice. Anyway, there's a lot of structure that's involved in this particular case. Let me do k equal 1. K equal 1, yeah, k equal 2, I will assign a metric study to Gross and Wilson. K equal 1 is the most recent of all of these. It's in a paper not yet published, but I got to hear two talks about the paper at the G2 collaboration meeting in North Carolina and about 3 weeks ago. And K equal 1 is a case due to Hine, Song, Vyacholsky. If we're lucky, Jeff will talk about some of this stuff when he's here in 2 weeks. And John. And really, I should say, G's John. I think it's G. There are a lot of people named John. So this is a case in which, I'm sorry, K equal 1 is not that case. Okay, K equal 1 is the simpler case of Hine, of Costello and Hine. I had it right the first time. Anyway, and this time I'm just going to do H, S, V, and Z. So this is the K equal 1 case. And in the K equal 1 case, I have actually a whole variety of examples. So there are, there's a finite collection of examples. And these are cases in which the fiber of X over B is a nil manifold, pi inverse of B, is a non-trivial null manifold. Well, there's one case where it's trivial, so I have to state this carefully. And B is just an interval. So if I'm going to think of B as being an entire interval, then I should take, if I'm going to think of it as having the endpoints in the interval, then I should take R equals 0. And, you know, it'll get expanded to infinite volume with a zero volume fiber if R is not 0. This is a nil manifold, so at R equal to infinity, we have two choices about which part of it we keep and which part of it we don't keep. So B is equal to 0, 1, but there are a collection of points, P1 up through Pn, in between 0 and 1, Pn minus 1 perhaps, in between 0 and 1, and there is a function which takes some value, so it's a function that I'm calling h of x, which is defined on 0, 1, and h of 0 is less than 0, h of 1 is bigger than 0, and at pi, h of pi minus epsilon plus 1 is h of pi plus epsilon. But you get to go from a starting point of your choice to an ending point of your choice, subject to the constraint that n minus 1, oh crap, n is less than or equal to 18. So that's the limit on the choices. And what's happening is there's a certain amount of twist on the nil manifold, and the twist on the nil manifold is changing when you go from point to point. So over this interval 0, 1, we have certain spaces which are four manifolds. I should have mentioned that there were spaces that were four manifolds or four dimensional spaces of certain kinds in neighborhoods of the points in the Gross-Wilson case. In the more general case that I'm considering here, I still have that situation of more of four-dimensional objects. So these four-dimensional objects are Tian-Yau manifolds. And they're obtained by taking a Delpezza surface, so a blow-up of P2 in K points, and we'll allow 9 points. So normally that's not quite a Delpezzo for DP9, but we'll allow 9 points. And we'll put a metric on the complement of a chosen curve in the anticanonical bundle of DPK. So there exists complete Ricci flat metrics. This is a theorem of Tian and Yau, which is what's going on here. There exists complete Ricci flat metrics on that four manifold, and that four manifold is diffeomorphic to what's going on near one end or the other. The two ends are related by an orientation reversal, which is why we've got the possibility of going down to minus 9 on one side and plus 9 on the other side. So there's some orientation issue that goes on. And then if you have one of the P's, there is a certain nil manifold on one side of the P and a different nil manifold on the other side of the P, and the data for changing from one nil manifold to another is jumping by 1 at that point. And so at that point, you have two different directions of the circle, and the circle is the three torus is becoming sort of long in the T2 direction and short in the P1 direction, in the S1 direction, near that point, whereas it's a little more uniform, the size that's happening out in the middle, in the middle region. So these four people recently constructed degenerations of this type. They had the kind of two-sided manifolds that interpolate between two nil manifold directions, and they had these Tianyao manifolds out here, and they carefully showed that you can glue together and then smooth out the resulting space to get a K3 manifold. So there is a parameter involved in their smoothing, which is the sizes of the circles that are involved, and those sizes tell you that you can do this construction okay, so long as the circles in X are relatively small compared to the size of B. So that at least constructs these examples in a neighborhood of a neighborhood of the corresponding boundary point, boundary locus. Now I want to make the similar construction that I made before, and to make that similar construction, I actually want to take the two torus at a general point of B, volume one, volume V, if you like, the two torus to be of finite size. I want to take the one torus to be of small size, VK going to zero. This is volume V, capital VK. And then the base is going to be a size, I have to make it V over, this is V, which is constant. And I have to take the base to be a size V over VK. So where do I get my two cycles in that case? My H2, well, I can take a VK from here together with either of the two cycles from here. So those are two shrinking cycles, VKV and VKV. Then I've got I've got two constant cycles because I can take the shrinking and the growing together, a VK and a V over VK, and I can take this two cycle that's in the middle. So I have two constants, and then I have two that are growing, so it's a V squared. This is just 1 over VK. So it's a V over VK and a V over VK. Anyway, like the previous case, it's not quite like the previous case. The invariant cycles are a 1, 1, which is why this is K equal 1. And then I have two shrinking cycles and two growing cycles of the two cycles. And I needed the two different sizes in the torus in order to get that pattern of how many invariant cycles and how many shrinking cycles I had. So that was k equals 1. And then I've got two k equals 0 cases, which I will admit I did not understand how they fit together as k equals 0 until after the meeting in Durham was over. So this is the inaugural account of this particular fact. So I've got a k equals 0 case that corresponds to the Foscolo-Hein results.
Just a short question about HSVZ. So what is the main result? That for such configuration, there exists a sequence of legitimate K3 surfaces.
That's right.
Degenerating into that?
Degenerating into that. And moreover, when they count parameters, they get exactly the correct parameter count to completely fill out a neighborhood of the boundary.
Mm-hmm. And the existence of such configuration, in other words, the necessary condition was sufficient, that was known before, or they also establish that?
There's one more thing I meant to mention about this case, which is the physical duality. And so from the point of view of physical duality, I guess it was kind of known before, but they put it in terms that were new, I would say. So I tried to guess what their result was going to be based on the abstract of the talk, and I guessed slightly wrong. Anyway, they say that the paper will be done soon, and the videos from that conference should be available soon. So,
perhaps both results are new, sufficientness and necessary. So, but then the configuration produces that configuration.
Yeah. So I think what's not new was the case where both k's were equal to 9. So that's a case that was really expected from the physics literature, at least. But the fact that you can vary the k's, and by the way, the fact that you can vary the k's is an indication that the strict description in terms of Borel-Serre is not correct. You have to do some blow-ups of the Borel-Serre locus to actually get things to fit together properly. So, in k equal 1, there will be a bunch of blow-ups depending on. You get, for each choice of left side, right side, you get the correct parameter count. So you get an entire boundary component for each choice. Okay, so there's the k equals 0 Foscolo-Hein. I don't want to go on forever. So the k equals 0 Foscolo-Hein was a case where you just had a circle, so pi from x to b collapses S1. And leaves you with dimension b equal 3. And if I go to the limit where r goes to 0, and it should be said that the singular fibers correspond to ALF spaces. So I should have mentioned that over here I had ALG spaces and maybe ALH spaces plus others. So there have been, there's this whole story of ALE, ALF, ALG, and ALH. And the story is, in the case of ALE points, that's pretty familiar. Those are C4 mod gammas, where gamma is a subgroup of SL2, C. Sorry. Subgroup of SL2C. And the ALF, ALG, and ALH are similar things, except that instead of an infinity keeping an entire three-sphere, you take some of the directions and make them toroidal. So you get one circle or two circles or three circles, depending on what kind of spaces you go for. And in particular, having one circle collapsing is going to mean ALF spaces. Now, ALF spaces have an interesting property. So the exact types of ALF spaces have recently been classified. They were classified by a guy named Minerva, and then later extended by Hein. I need to do a little research to see if Chen and Chen are supposed to be cited for those. I'm not sure if they need to be cited for the ALF, probably not. In ALF spaces, you get A types, and you get D types, but you get no E types. So it's an odd fact. People treated this fact as a failure of construction initially. They had ways of getting ALF spaces for A types and D types. It was a little odd because there were a few extra D types that weren't there in the ALE construction. ALE subgroups, by the way, are A types, which are cyclic groups, D types, which are binary dihedral groups, and then three exceptional E types. But the E types are now known not to extend to ALF spaces, so you get ALF spaces but no no E-type limits. If I do, the my little analysis of this going with size VK and the complement, the B, going with size V over VK, well, this has three cycles altogether. And what you discover is three cycles grow, three cycles shrink. And no cycles are invariant. So from the point of view of just analyzing these, this three-dimensional space, we would conclude that it's type k equals 0. It's one of the k equals 0 cases. And the fact that there are no ALF spaces of type E suggests that of the two basic lattices that I can get in the k equals 0 case, I don't want the E-type lattice because I wouldn't be able to realize the E singularities. So this one I naturally identify with O sub O, the orthogonal k equals 0 case. Whereas the other k equals 0 case, so the other k equals 0 case is analyzed by Chen and Chen. It involves precisely the opposite, a pi x to b, where the dimension of the fiber is 3 and the dimension of the base is 1. But the same analysis shows that three cycles grow, three cycles shrink, and over B, you have the picture of a kind of ALH space on the ends, and those ALH spaces can include E-type singularities. So it's natural to identify this one with 0 sub E. So two things which are very different geometrically are corresponding to the two k equals 0 components of the corresponding moduli space. Now, what I haven't had a chance to talk about today at all, I'm out of time, I'm well out of time. So I talked in k equal 2 about the physical interpretation of the dual. I didn't talk about that in k equal 1 or the k equal 0 cases, but in those cases, there are natural duals. The duals involve, again, the natural duals involve type 2, the Hojava-Witten dual of the heterotic string, and various other constructions. Maybe I'll come back to that topic in some future lecture. But the duality that I haven't really discussed at all is a duality to the heterotic string, which is a duality that involves taking the small volume K3 and turning it into a large volume heterotic. So large volume heterotic has a good way of being analyzed perturbatively, and this is part of the important story, identifying which two types of families of degenerate K3s will correspond to the two different types of perturbative heterotic string. And in particular, the identification with the EH string relies in part on this observation that there are no E's in this case. Therefore, this case should be the O string, and that case should be the E string. There's more to it than that. There's also a nice construction when the when you're approaching the appropriate limit in the E8 case, you'll get a collection of three tori, which are shrinking to zero size, and which naturally carry an E8 gauge field on them. And that E8 gauge field is the way to make the duality to the heterodyne string even more explicit than this story. But this story is sort of fully contained in the K3 case. So I think I'll stop there, and I might continue some other time.
At the beginning, didn't you say that K runs up to 19? No,
because K was only the dimension of an isotropic subspace, so it's the minimum of the two numbers.
Right? So 0, 1, 2, 3, right?
0, 1, 2, 3. And, K equals 3 does not occur. K equals 3 is in the middle of the space, so I don't have a boundary for K equals 3. You have to have proper K. Okay.